This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, a 10% Happier How-To Book by Dan Harris and Jeff Warren with Carly Adler. This is the author, Dan Harris. The untrained mind is stupid. Ajahn Chah, Meditation Master. How to use this book. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given that this is a book about meditation, you will hear plenty of meditations throughout this program. I always find it extremely annoying when books lay out a practice and then say, don't move on, don't turn the page until you do this. So in this audiobook, Jeff, my co-author and meditation maestro, reads the meditations in a normal voice, and you shouldn't feel like you have to stop everything and meditate. In fact, they aren't really guided meditations at all. They're part of the book's learning, and they're both hilarious and instructive. So just listen normally instead of catapulting yourself into a pretzel. And if you happen to be in the mood to do an actual meditation, we have included a few proper guided audio meditations in the appendix of this audiobook, where Jeff will walk you through the practice. You can also get short and long versions of every meditation in this book for free on the 10% Happier app. Go to 10percenthappier.com/access, 10percenthappier.com/access, to download the app and unlock all of the content. If you happen to already have the app, just use that same URL to get the meditations in question. Also on the app, you'll be able to watch videos of many of the adventures and misadventures described in this book. Chapter 1, The Case for Meditation. If you had told me as recently as a few years ago that I would someday become a traveling evangelist for meditation, I would have coughed my beer up through my nose. In 2004, I had a panic attack while delivering the news live on ABC's Good Morning America. Being a masochist, I asked our research department to tell me exactly how many people were watching. They came back with the vastly reassuring number of 5.019 million. If you're in the mood for a nice dose of schadenfreude, you can readily find the whole clip on YouTube. Just search for panic attack on live TV and it will pop right up, which is awesome for me. In the wake of my nationally televised freakout, I learned something even more embarrassing. The entire episode had been caused by some phenomenally stupid behavior in my personal life. After spending years covering war zones for ABC News as an ambitious and idealistic young reporter, I had developed an undiagnosed depression. For months, I was having trouble getting out of bed in the morning and felt as if I had a permanent low-grade fever. Out of desperation, I began self-medicating with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. My drug use was short-lived and intermittent. If you've ever seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, in which the characters are pounding Quaaludes every 5 minutes, it was nothing like that. However, my consumption was enough, according to the doctor I consulted after the panic attack, to artificially raise the level of adrenaline in my brain, exacerbating my baseline anxiety and priming me to have my very public meltdown. Through a strange and circuitous series of events, the panic attack ultimately led me to embrace a practice I had always dismissed as ridiculous. For most of my life, to the extent that I'd ever even considered meditation, I ranked it right alongside aura readings, Enya, and the unironic use of the word namaste. Further, I figured my racing type A mind was way too busy to ever be able to commune with the cosmos. And anyway, if I got too happy, it would probably render me completely ineffective at my hyper-competitive job. Two things changed my mind. The first was the science. In recent years, there's been an explosion of research into meditation, which has been shown to reduce blood pressure, boost recovery after the release of the stress hormone cortisol, improve immune system functioning and response, slow age-related atrophy of the brain, and mitigate the symptoms of depression and anxiety. Studies also show meditation can reduce violence in prisons, boost productivity in the workplace, and improve both behavior and grades for school children. Things get really interesting when you look at the neuroscience. In recent years, neuroscientists have been peering into the heads of meditators, and they found that the practice can rewire key parts of the brain involved with self-awareness, compassion, and resiliency. One study from the Harvard Gazette found that just 8 weeks of meditation resulted in measurable decreases in gray matter density in the area of the brain associated with stress. The science is still in its early stages, and the findings are preliminary. I worry that it has provoked a certain amount of irrational exuberance in the media. Meditation can cure halitosis and enable you to dunk on a regulation hoop. However, when you aggregate the most rigorous studies, they strongly suggest that daily meditation can deliver a long list of health benefits. The research has catalyzed a fascinating public health revolution, with the ancient practice of meditation catching on among corporate executives, athletes, U.S. Marines, and entertainers, including the rapper 50 Cent. That man got shot 9 times. I believe he deserves some peace of mind. The second thing I learned that changed my mind about meditation is that it does not necessarily entail a lot of the weird stuff I feared it might. Contrary to popular belief, meditation does not involve folding yourself into a pretzel, joining a group, or wearing special outfits. The word meditation is a little bit like the word sports. There are hundreds of varieties. The type of meditation we'll be teaching in this audiobook is called mindfulness meditation, which is derived from Buddhism but does not require adopting a belief system or declaring oneself to be a Buddhist. In defense of Buddhism, by the way, it is often practiced not as a faith but as a set of tools to help people lead more fulfilled lives in a universe characterized by impermanence and entropy. One of my favorite quotes on the matter is, "Buddhism is not something to believe in, but rather something to do." In any event, what we're teaching here is simple, secular exercise for your brain. To give you a sense of exactly how simple it is, here are the 3-step instructions for beginning meditation. You don't actually have to do this right now. I will bring in a ringer soon. Step 1. Sit comfortably. It's best to have your spine reasonably straight, which may help prevent an involuntary nap. If you want to sit on the floor in the lotus position, go for it. If not, just sit in a chair, as I do. You can close your eyes, or if you prefer, you can leave them open slightly and adjust your gaze to a neutral point on the ground. Step 2. Bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and out. Pick a spot where it's most prominent, your chest, your belly, or your nostrils. You're not thinking about your breath, you're just feeling the raw data of the physical sensations. To help maintain focus, you can make a quiet mental note on the in-breath and out-breath, like in and out. Step 3. The third step is the key. As soon as you try to do this, your mind is almost certainly going to mutiny. You'll start having all sorts of random thoughts, such as, what's for lunch? Do I need a haircut? What was Casper the Friendly Ghost before he died? Who was the Susan after whom they named the Lazy Susan, and how did she feel about it? No big deal. This is totally normal. The whole game is simply to notice when you are distracted and begin again, and again, and again. Every time you catch yourself wandering and escort your attention back to the breath, it is like a bicep curl for the brain. It's also a radical act. You're breaking a lifetime's habit of walking around in a fog of rumination and projection, and you're actually focusing on what's happening right now. I have heard from countless people who assume that they could never meditate because they can't stop thinking. I cannot say this frequently enough. The goal is not to clear your mind, but instead to focus your mind for a few nanoseconds at a time, and whenever you become distracted, just start again. Getting lost and starting over is not failing at meditation. It is succeeding. I think this pernicious clear-the-mind misconception stems in part from the fact that meditation has been the victim of the worst marketing campaign for anything ever. The traditional art depicting meditation, while often beautiful, can be badly misleading. It usually shows practitioners with beatific looks on their faces. The truth is, meditation can be difficult, especially at the beginning. It's like going to the gym. If you work out and you're not panting or sweating, you're probably cheating. Likewise, if you start meditating and find yourself in a thought-free field of bliss, either you have rocketed to enlightenment or you have died. The practice does get easier the longer you keep at it, but even after doing it for years, I get lost all the time. Here's a random sample of my mental chatter during a typical meditation session. In. Out. Man, I am feeling antsy. What's the Yiddish term my grandmother used to use for that? Spielkies, right. Words that make me giggle. Ointment. Pianist. Wait, what? Come on, man. Back to the breath. In. Out. Likes. Baked goods. Dislikes. Fedoras. Dream sequences. That part in techno songs where the French accordion kicks in. Dude, come on. In. Out. In. Alternative jobs. Papal nuncio, interpretive dancer. Working double time on the seduction line. Anyway, you get the idea. So why put yourself through all of this? Meditation forces you into a direct collision with a fundamental fact of life that is not often pointed out to us. We all have a voice in our heads. When I talk about the voice in your head, I'm not referring to schizophrenia or anything like that. I'm talking about your internal narrator. It's sometimes called your ego. The Buddha had a cool name for it, the monkey mind. Here are some key attributes of the voice in my head. I suspect they will sound familiar. It's often fixated on the past and future at the expense of whatever is happening right now. The voice loves to plan, plot, and scheme. It's always making lists or rehearsing arguments or drafting tweets. One moment it has you fantasizing about some halcyon past or Elysian future. Another moment you're rueing old mistakes or catastrophizing about some not yet arrived events. As Mark Twain is reputed to have said, some of the worst things in my life never even happened. The voice is insatiable. The default mental condition for too many human beings is dissatisfaction. Under the sway of the ego, nothing is good enough. We're always on the hunt for the next dopamine hit. We hurl ourselves headlong from one cookie, one promotion, one party to the next, and yet a great many of us are never fully sated. How many meals, movies, and vacations have you enjoyed? And are you done? Of course not. The voice is unrelievably self-involved. We are all the stars of our own movies, whether we cast ourselves as hero, victim, black hat, or all three. True, we can get temporarily sucked into other people's stories, but often as a means of comparing ourselves to them. Everything ultimately gets subordinated to the one plot line that matters, the story of me. In short, the voice in my head, and perhaps also yours, can be an asshole. To be fair, our internal narrator is not all bad. It is capable of brilliance, humor, and compassion. It is also extremely useful when designing irrigation systems and composing piano sonatas. Nevertheless, when I bother to listen, most of what I hear inside is rather obnoxious. I am not alone in this. I have a friend, a fellow meditator, who jokes that when he considers the voice in his head, he feels like he's been kidnapped by the most boring person alive who says the same baloney over and over, most of it negative, nearly all of it self-referential. And when you're unaware of this ceaseless inner talk fest, it can control and deceive you. The ego's terrible suggestions often come to the party dressed up as common sense. You should eat that entire sleeve of Oreos. You've had a hard day. Go ahead. You have every right to make the wisecrack that will ruin the next 48 hours of your marriage. You don't need to meditate. You'll never be able to do it anyway. One of the things that most powerfully drew me to meditation was the realization, many years after the fact, sadly, that the voice in my head was responsible for the most mortifying moment of my life, my on-air panic attack. It was because of my ego that I went off to war zones without considering the psychological consequences, was insufficiently self-aware to recognize my subsequent depression, and then blindly self-medicated. I began my meditation practice slowly, with just 5 to 10 minutes a day, which is what I recommend everyone aim for at the start. And frankly, if you only find time for 1 minute a day, you can count that as a win. Much more on this soon. For me, the first sign that meditation was not a waste of time came within weeks when I started to overhear my wife, Bianca, at cocktail parties telling friends that I had become less of a jerk. Internally, I pretty quickly began to notice three primary benefits in ascending order of importance. One, calm. The act of stepping out of my daily busyness for a few minutes and simply breathing often injected a dose of sanity into my hectic day. It served to interrupt, if only briefly, the current of mindlessness that often carried me along. The issue of calmness is a bit tricky, though. Many people are drawn to meditation because they want to relax, but they end up disappointed because the ever-declaiming ego keeps butting in, or because itches and knee pain arise. While meditation can often be calming, it's best not to go into it expecting to feel a certain way. And importantly, even if an individual meditation session isn't mellow, I've found that the net effect of having a daily practice is that overall my emotional weather is significantly balmier. Second benefit, focus. We live in an era defined by what's been called omni-connectivity. Many of us are beset by emails, texts, status updates, and push notifications. It can leave us feeling frayed and frazzled. In my job, I actually have other people's voices piped directly into my head, and I have to get the facts straight on short notice in front of large audiences. I found that the daily exercise of trying to focus on one thing at a time, my breath, and then getting lost and starting again and again and again, helped me stay on task during the course of my day. Studies show the more you meditate, the better you are at activating the regions of the brain associated with attention and deactivating the regions associated with mind-wandering. Third benefit, mindfulness. This rather anodyne-sounding word has become quite buzzy of late. There are now countless books and articles on mindful eating, mindful parenting, mindful sex, mindful dishwashing, mindful yarn bombing, mindful conjugation of verbs in Esperanto, and on and on. The media fuss has at times turned this down-to-earth, universally accessible concept into an impossibly precious thing and provoked a not entirely unjustified backlash. And yet, if you can get past the breathless headlines and press releases, mindfulness is an enormously useful skill. It is a rich and ancient term with lots of meanings, but here's my personal definition. Mindfulness is the ability to see what's happening in your head at any given moment so that you don't get carried away by it. As an example, imagine you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off. How does that moment go for you usually? If you're like me, you may feel a big blast of anger, which is normal. But then you might automatically act on that anger, honking and cursing and so on. There's no buffer between the stimulus and your reflexive reaction. With mindfulness on board, the self-awareness generated by a deliberate daily reckoning with the voice in your head, that moment might go a little differently. After getting cut off, you'll probably still have that upsurge of anger, but this time you may have room for a saner thought track. Oh, my chest is buzzing. My ears are turning red. I'm experiencing a starburst of self-righteous thoughts. I'm working myself up into a homicidal rage here. Now that you've developed this mindful early warning system, however, you actually have a choice in the matter. You don't have to take the bait, succumb to your anger, and chase the other driver down the road hurling expletives with your kids in the back seat, fearing you've lost your mind. It's a little bit like the picture-in-picture function on your television. All of a sudden, the story that has been taking up the whole screen can be seen with some perspective. Another way to think about this concept is to visualize the mind as a waterfall. The water is your nonstop stream of consciousness, which consists mostly of me, me, me thoughts. Mindfulness is the area behind the waterfall, which allows you to step out of the cascade and view your urges, impulses, and desires without getting caught up in it all. I am not making this up. Our species is classified as Homo sapiens sapiens, the one who thinks and knows he or she thinks. However, that second sapiens often falls by the wayside because nobody bothers to point out to us that we have this natural capacity to view the contents of our consciousness with some non-judgmental remove. Mindfulness is your birthright. The ego's writ only extends so far. You have the ability to resist its misrule, to break out of the prison of neurotic self-obsession. I hasten to add that the idea is not that you should be rendered into a lifeless blob, passively letting people cut you off or walk all over you. What mindfulness has allowed me to do is respond wisely to things instead of reacting impulsively. Respond, not react. This is a game changer. Most meditation cliches, invocations of a sacred space, injunctions to be here now, make me want to put a pencil through my eye, although I have learned through meditation to let that urge pass too. However, this venerable cliche, respond, not react, is genuinely transformational. If I weren't so allergic to pain, I might get it tattooed on my chest. To be sure, I remain a stout defender of worrying. It seems obvious to me that in order to do anything great, a certain amount of hand-wringing is part of the deal. As of the recording of this audiobook, I have been meditating for 8 years, roughly, and am still plenty ambitious. However, these days, I'm not as sweaty, agitated, and unpleasant about it as I used to be. Meditation has helped me to sort my useless rumination from what I call constructive anguish. The less enchanted you are by the voice in your head, the more you can make room for entirely new kinds of thoughts and feelings to emerge. Switching out of egoic autopilot may help you clear away space for concern about other people or to better connect with what is right in front of you. In my case, it has enabled me to take even more delight in my work, my wife, and our toddler son, Alexander, who suffuses me with warmth whether he's offering me a chicken nugget or wiping macerated muffin on my sleeve. I am less enthralled to my desires and aversions, which has given me a wider perspective and, at times, a taste of a deep, ineffable unclenching. To sum up, meditation empowers you to tap into what lies beneath or beyond the ego. Call it creativity. Call it your innate wisdom. Some people call it your heart. Ew. While meditation is an amazing inner technology, it is not a one-way ticket to flawlessness, which is why I called my first book 10% Happier. It buys me a lot of leeway to continue to mess up. If my wife were writing this book, she could marshal plenty of evidence behind her 90% still a moron thesis. Similarly, my younger brother Matt, who has always enjoyed puncturing my pretense, argues that the real title for my first book should have been From Deeply Flawed to Merely Flawed. Perfection may not be on offer, but something profound and empowering is indeed available. The fact that our minds are trainable. We spend so much time working on our stock portfolios, our cars, and our interior design, but almost no time working on the one filter through which we experience it all, our minds. Many of us assume that happiness can be measured solely by the quality of our work life, our love life, or our childhood. These are vitally important, of course, but what the science is showing us is that happiness is not just something that happens to you, it is a skill. That is a huge headline, which has fueled both my personal practice and my career as a meditation proponent. At the outset of my unlikely evangelical side hustle, I assumed that if I simply explained all of the foregoing, the scientific research, the blazingly obvious utility of mindfulness, the aspirational figures who are now on the meditation bandwagon, everyone would just start meditating. That's how it worked with me. As a journalist, when I took a hard look at the studies, I began practicing every day. I certainly do not mean to imply that I am an avatar of discipline. One night last year, I ate so many cookies that I puked. True story. It was not my unique willpower that made my adoption of meditation relatively seamless. It was pain. I have endured episodic depression and anxiety, along with the odd serving of panic and substance abuse, since I was a little boy. Anyone who has lived under the low cloud ceiling of despair will understand my eagerness to embrace a potential antidote. When it became clear to me that meditation could help stave off or alleviate what Churchill called the black dog by helping me achieve some distance from my sometimes bleak and repetitive patterns of thought, establishing the habit became a non-issue. I now realize my somewhat idiosyncratic adoption of daily meditation led me to underestimate the myths, misconceptions, and self-deceptions that can keep people from meditating, and to drive a message that was both artless and a little cavalier. In essence, my argument to anyone who asked me how to get started was, just suck it up and do it. Turns out, changing human behavior is not that simple, not by a long shot. Studies suggest millions of Americans are meditating. I suspect there are tens of millions more who are eager, but somehow unable to start their own practice. As a friend of mine involved in corporate well-being at Google has said, we have medicine that works, and most people don't do it. Even my own wife, who, if she's listening to this, is beautiful and perfect in every other way, does not meditate. She's a scientist. She unquestionably groks the potential health benefits. She lives with me, so she deeply appreciates how the practice has made me less annoying. And yet she cannot overcome inertia and make herself do it with any consistency. I wonder sometimes whether I've hurt my cause by regularly asking her, what's it like to be married to your spiritual leader? Whereas I was once obsessed with simply demystifying meditation as a way to popularize the practice, I am now fixated on finding specific ways of helping people get over the hump and actually do the thing. My first move was to co-found a company that teaches meditation through an app called 10% Happier Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. Our strategy has been to recruit the world's best teachers, strip away the pan flute music, and inject a little humor into the teaching of meditation. Building this business has given me a front row seat at the rich pageant of human neuroses that stand in the way of committing to a short daily habit that is manifestly beneficial. As part of our marketing research, during which we conduct extensive interviews with customers and ex-customers, my team and I started to develop a list of the primary obstacles to meditation, such as finding the time, fearing you might somehow lose your edge, or believing the practice somehow entails magically clearing your mind. We called them the secret fears, although technically they were not all fears. I got so interested in helping people overcome these fears that I decided to write this book, which is designed to systematically taxonomize and tackle the most common stumbling blocks and also teach you to meditate. But since I am not a meditation teacher, I needed to enlist someone who actually knows what he's talking about. So I reached out to a man I like to call the Meditation MacGyver. The first time I heard the name Jeff Warren was when I happened upon an article he penned for the New York Times website about how he went on a crazy 30-day solo silent meditation retreat. Before you dismiss him as a nut job, realize that this is exactly the kind of thing you want your meditation teacher to be doing, just as you want your fitness coach to have done triathlons and the like. The piece was written with style and humor. In the following passage, Jeff talks about a moment several days in when all the boredom and doubt that one normally encounters at the beginning of a retreat began to dissipate. Quote, "Then one afternoon, I realized that actually things were fine, better than fine. I felt as though I had atomic vision. My attention was zingy, electric. I noticed everything, bap, 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 flickers of intention before each movement, a vibrating topography of tensions and fluctuations under my belly skin, even my own keenly observant self, such a good noticer. I noticed my ambition, my self-satisfaction, my disappointment that there was no one around to brag to about my progress. You wouldn't believe how hard I can look at that tree." After reading the article, I mounted a campaign of what could fairly be called digital stalking. I learned that Jeff had happened upon the practice in much the same way I had, through journalism. While writing a book about the science of consciousness, which was called The Head Trip and was published to great reviews, by the way, he became intrigued by meditation. He discovered that it helped in his lifelong struggle with the hyperkinetic voice in his head, which often left him feeling, quote, trapped behind a spinning barrier of rumination. My kind of guy. He became an avid student, although he only reluctantly took on the role of teacher. When he initially founded his meditation group in Toronto, which he called the Consciousness Explorers Club, or CEC, he was simply looking for contemplative compatriots. But so many people started showing up and asking him questions that his own teacher advised him to pay it forward. My online sleuthing took me to the group's website where I subscribed to the monthly email newsletter in which Jeff talked about all of the CEC's activities, meditation, fun community service projects, epic dance parties. For the first time in my life, I actually kind of wanted to move to Canada. Here was this person who was young, meaning my age, which I will always consider young, a fantastic writer, and obviously way further along than I was on the meditative path. I made it my business to force him to be my friend. I tracked him down via email and made him promise to alert me whenever he next came to New York City. Not long thereafter, we met for brunch at a French spot near my apartment. In person, Jeff did not disappoint. He was a little hungover from a big night out with friends, but I saw no evidence of diminished capacity. We bonded over our mutual love of the practice. As nerdy as I had become about meditation by this time, Jeff thoroughly outdid me. He seemed to have read about and or tried nearly every contemplative tradition under the sun. He spoke with infectious ardor about the potential of meditation to mold the mind, his tastefully tattooed forearms gesticulating magisterially as he made his points. He did at times lapse into a sort of mystical poesy that I didn't fully understand, but I didn't care. We took a rambling, postprandial walk around Upper Manhattan, talking about meditation, writing, and relationships. He mentioned that he had been dating a whip-smart reporter named Sarah for over a year, and that they were currently discussing whether to get more serious. Reflecting back on my own issues, as someone who had waited until relatively late in life to get married, I told him that sometimes you won't know how good a relationship can be until you get out of your own way and commit. By the end of our afternoon together, I was thoroughly invigorated. I had collected innumerable meditation tips as well as a long list of recommended reading. My man crush was sealed. 2 years later, during which time we stayed connected via email and shared meals when we were in the same city, I recruited Jeff for a special project for the 10% Happier app. Until this point, most of the video content we produced was pretty basic, me and a teacher sitting on chairs in a studio talking about the practice. My team and I decided to up our game by taking the show on the road. We wanted to do a modern version of what monks had been doing for millennia, a so-called wandering retreat. We hatched a plan to bring Jeff to New York City, wire up a car with cameras, fill it with camping gear, and drive off with no itinerary for 3 days. During our long, chatty car rides, I got to know Jeff even better. On many levels, we have a lot in common. We both come from loving families. Jeff's parents, an engineer and a public health nurse, raised him and his two younger siblings in Montreal and Toronto. We're also both mildly obsessed with indie rock and spend way too much time thinking about meditation. On many other levels, however, we are polar opposites. Jeff, for example, was thrilled that we were going camping, an activity I have loathed ever since my parents, recovering hippies, forced me into the mountains with them practically every summer of my childhood. More significantly, when it came to major life choices, Jeff and I had traveled very different paths. After college, Jeff bounced around Europe and North and Central America, sometimes following women he was dating. He was in search of both adventure and meaning. He did landscaping, mixed cement, wrote movie reviews, worked on software for children, and later became a radio reporter. Even now, in his mid-40s and firmly established as a meditation teacher, he lived in a big rental house in downtown Toronto with artsy roommates. In stark contrast to Jeff's bohemian bent, I was decidedly more careerist. I had started in television news at age 22 and had been working my way up the ladder ever since. It wasn't that Jeff lacked ambition. He was profoundly committed to building the CEC, pursuing his writing, and deepening his meditation practice. It's just that his measures of success were less bougie than mine. It was on this trip that I started calling Jeff Meditation MacGyver, because anytime an issue arose, a traffic jam, a disagreement about where to pitch our tents, or someone, usually me, getting cranky, Jeff would pipe up with, "I've got a practice for that." He just loves getting under the hood and helping people figure out how their minds work. While I was incredibly impressed with Jeff's performance on this trip, I did notice one slight tick, an occasional penchant for embarking on excitable verbal jags about esoteric meditation topics. What was charming and intoxicating over dinner could be suboptimal when filming a course for rank-and-file meditators. For example, he actually uttered the following sentence. "You can shift into a kind of feeling of your own being, of your own headlessness. This just immediately diminishes the figure of content you were suffering about, you know?" No, Jeff, I don't. Regardless, the reaction to Jeff from app users was overwhelmingly positive. One person affectionately described him as a cross between the Buddha and Jeff Spicoli. Most people, though, had the same question. Is he single? You can't see him because this is an audiobook, but trust me, he's a good-looking guy. Before you get too excited, though, no, he is not single. He is still with Sarah. Beyond his chiseled good looks and the fact that he can take a joke, The true source of Jeff's appeal, and a big part of why I recruited him as my co-author for this book, is something much deeper. He is one of us. I'm like the anti-Buddha, he says. One of my biggest beefs with the meditation world is that too many teachers present themselves as paragons of imperturbability. Making matters worse, many of them talk in creamy voices that are supremely soporific and also deeply off-putting to hard-charging, skeptical people like me. Jeff talks like a normal person. Moreover, he is a normal and openly flawed person. I've never been calm, naturally placid, what you might imagine a meditation teacher to look like. I'm super ADD, he says. I get dysregulated really easily, or I'll be overthinking stuff too much because I can get in my head a lot. That line about ADD is not a throwaway. Jeff has struggled with attention deficit disorder since he was a child. For him, it doesn't manifest the way you might think. Instead of being unable to focus, he often gets hyper-focused before his attention is inevitably hijacked by something new. As he's explained it to me, he considers ADD to be both his greatest strength and his greatest liability. On the one hand, it allows him to lock in and be extremely engaged and open with people. It's part of what makes him such a popular teacher. But in many other areas of his life, ADD has been, as he calls it, a disaster. For years, it made it hard for him to finish writing projects or stay interested in jobs and relationships. That provoked a pattern of endless strategizing and disappointment, which left him, quote, in agony. Meditation, he says, calmed and grounded him, and it taught him you cannot run from your baggage. You need to see it clearly so that it doesn't yank you around. Meditation, says Jeff, is about bringing into awareness some habit that was previously unconscious. Insofar as it's unconscious, you have no perspective around it. It totally governs you. It owns you. You're being hurtled along automatically by it. As soon as you can start to notice that happening and see it, then it becomes less and less of a problem. So I'm at the point in my life, having practiced enough, that I can now see where most of my neurotic struggles are, and because I can see them, I can admit to them, and they end up being less of a problem. This is the beauty of meditation, the superpower, the judo move. What you see clearly cannot drive you. Ignorance is not bliss. Meditation really can change your life. That is why both Jeff and I feel so strongly about helping people overcome the many stumbling blocks so that they can actually start practicing. If I had one thing on my agenda, says Jeff, it would be to make people feel better about the fact that everyone's got their own neurotic stuff. Also, I don't require anyone to join my cult, although I do encourage it. So, yeah, I recruited a wise-ass Canadian with ADD to join me on this mission to help people meditate. Our initial thought was that we wanted to do some sort of road trip since our wandering retreat had worked so well. The idea was to travel around, meet people struggling with various secret fears, and give them a hand. In one of our many brainstorming meetings with members of the 10% Happier team, someone casually mentioned we should get a rock star bus and go across the country. Everyone laughed at how ridiculous the notion was. So we did it. We ended up renting a huge orange bus and slapping a massive 10% Happier decal on both sides. The bus rental company, Rock Safaris, promptly provided us with two key data points. One, every experienced road warrior knows there is one hard and fast rule, which is that there is no making number two on the bus. You're supposed to hold it until you get to a rest stop. And two, the most recent occupants of this particular vehicle were the members of the legendary band Parliament Funkadelic. I was pretty sure we were going to be the most boring people ever to ride on this bus. We spent months planning the trip. There were nearly a dozen key players involved, many of whom you will meet soon. We held weekly planning calls. Where should we go? Whom should we see? Can we make it from New Orleans to El Paso in one go? No. Where is the world's largest ball of yarn? Not on our route, sadly. We aimed to find interesting and diverse groups of people who wanted to practice but weren't actually doing it. We mapped a cross-country itinerary. We got a crash course in the rules that govern how long bus drivers can legally be behind the wheel. We had the brilliant idea to order a customized meditation booth where we could offer free lessons to the passing masses. The entire endeavor was a logistical nightmare. The primary goal of the trip was to create a thorough classification of all the different kinds of jacked up meditators out there. But we set ourselves two firm rules. First, be realistic. We wanted to be as pragmatic as possible about what it takes to establish a meditation practice. The fact is, habit formation is hard. What works for you may not work for others, and what may do the trick for you at one time may no longer cut it at some later date. So the essence of our approach is, here are some tactics that seem to work, try them, experiment, and if you fall off the wagon, we can troubleshoot that too. The second rule, no proselytizing. Although this book is shamelessly pro-meditation, we are not interested in strong-arming people who aren't into it. On our road trip, we would speak only with people who actually wanted to meditate. Living with a wife who is a non-meditator, I've learned the hard way that proselytizing is a shortcut to getting the stink eye or, worse, a smack in the head. I try to remain mindful of a great New Yorker cartoon that shows two women having lunch. One of them says to the other, "I've been gluten-free for a week, and I'm already annoying." After 11 days in 18 states, I feel confident in saying we fulfilled our mission. We met cops, military cadets, politicians, celebrities, social workers, and formerly incarcerated youth. We covered more than 3,000 miles. We ate deliciously fattening food, and we didn't kill each other. Although, as you will hear, we did come close. The resulting book, to which you are now listening, is designed not only to provide practical advice for surmounting the obstacles to meditation, but also to teach you, in a simple and accessible manner, how to practice. One of the unique things Jeff offers here is different meditations for different kinds of situations and challenges and temperaments. Neither of us believes there is a one-size-fits-all meditative solution. Nor, as I've said before, do we believe that meditation is a miracle cure for everything that ails you. We make no grandiose promises. If you're looking for instant enlightenment, a third eye optician, or a cup of fresh brewed kombucha, you have come to the wrong place. What we do hope to provide is a well-reasoned route toward increased sanity through mindfulness. Call it chicken soup for the skeptic. The best way to understand both the benefits and the challenges of meditation is to see how the practice plays out in an individual mind, which is why Jeff and I offer ourselves up as guinea pigs here, allowing you to see the inside story, so to speak. As we traveled across the country, ostensibly with the goal of helping other people, some of our deepest foibles were exposed. While meditation is not a cure-all, it is an adventure, and sometimes a bumpy one at that. Especially bumpy, in this case, for me. During the course of our meditation tour, I ended up learning some hard, even humiliating lessons about my own hang-ups and insecurities. Indeed, as you're about to hear, on the very first day, it was powerfully revealed to me that I was very often failing to practice what I preach, that, in fact, I had been a towering hypocrite. Chapter 2. I Can't Do This. TV newsrooms are like the embodiment of the monkey mind, characterized by bright lights, bottomless vanity, and the collective attention span of a syphilitic squirrel. I have spent my entire adult life in this milieu, one that is decidedly uncongenial to meditation. My on-air colleagues and I are conditioned to avoid dead air at all costs, so we are constantly scanning the conversational landscape for the opportunity to make the next quip. We monitor the ratings, read our Twitter replies, and tend to develop the kind of self-consciousness that comes from always being watched and evaluated. All of which I figured made my workplace the perfect crucible in which to kick off our road trip. It was 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, and I was walking onto the set where we record the weekend editions of Good Morning America. I had a camera crew in tow from the 10% Happier app that would be documenting the entire expedition. On this inaugural morning, the plan was to film some behind-the-scenes footage of me preparing for the show, after which we would convene my fellow anchors and see if they could stay quiet long enough to meditate. As I sat down at my computer, nested in a pod of workstations off to the side of the set, my co-host, Paula Ferris, sauntered over and made herself at home on my desk. She had noticed the crew and decided she did not want to waste a prime opportunity to publicly mock me. "Has Dan told you what our idea for his follow-up book should be, the sequel? Can we say it on camera? She asked, glint in her eye, clearly intent on revealing her idea no matter what. 10% happier, but still a douchebag. Every weekend morning since 2010, I've been getting up at 3:45 to anchor this show. When the alarm goes off at that ungodly hour, the first thought that often pops into my head is, why the hell am I doing this? But then I realize I'm going to a job I adore with people I love. Paula, who alternately refers to herself as my work wife or the little sister Dan never wanted, is a big part of the draw. On paper, we are diametric opposites. She grew up in a conservative Christian family in the Midwest. I was raised in ultra-liberal Massachusetts by a pair of secular scientists. Paula and her husband take their three children to church on Sundays. Bianca and I are devout agnostics. But these differences have formed the foundation of a real friendship. On work days, Paula and I jointly craft the questions we ask of the political analysts who appear on the show, our differing backgrounds ensuring, we believe, increased fairness. On our off days, we text about child rearing, theology, and the latest office gossip. People often come up to me, strangers at airports, staffers in the newsroom, even members of senior management, and ask, do you guys really like each other as much as it seems on TV? The answer is yes. That Sunday, after we wrapped up the show, Paula and I retired, along with the rest of our on-air team, to a conference room on the 13th floor of our office building for a meditation tutorial. Jeff was already there when we arrived, looking sharp in a first day of school kind of way, wearing a blue button-down shirt, a new pair of black sneakers, and striped socks. He later told me that a stylist friend of his had taken pity on his outmoded wardrobe and hooked him up with better clothes for this road trip. The 10% Happier crew had set up all the cameras and lights and were ready to roll. Rob and Ron loped in. Ron Claiborne is the newsreader on Weekend GMA, meaning he comes on near the top of the show to deliver the morning's headlines. A Yaley with an allergy to bullshit and pretense of any variety, he's been with ABC News for 30 years and is beloved for his journalistic experience and wry humor. As an example, shortly after my first book came out, he held up his own homemade version on the air called 11% Happier. If you're only going to buy one book, he told the audience, do the math. Today, he was wearing a suit coat and tie with cargo pants and sneakers. In other words, the sartorial version of a mullet. Rob Marciano is our meteorologist. If I looked like him, I would probably be insufferable. He is tall and impossibly handsome, although he doesn't seem to know it. He is goofy and warm. He manages to dress impeccably, generally a tailored suit, silver tie clip, and white pocket square, and yet not look like a fop. Finally, Sarah Haynes came bounding in, late and breathless after running from the subway station. Until recently, Sarah had been our spirited, irrepressible pop news anchor, basically GMA branding for entertainment reporter. But she had recently left for a job as co-host of The View, ABC's weekday morning chat show, where she was a rising star. Even though it was her day off, she had agreed to join our meditation confab. All four of my co-hosts were what I would call meditation curious. Everyone but Ron had tried it. All of them, given their stressful jobs and busy lives, were intrigued by the advertised benefits, or at least they pretended to be after having been forced to listen to me yammer about the practice for years, but none of them had managed to establish an abiding habit. As soon as the discussion got going, we very quickly bumped into one of the biggest obstacles facing aspiring meditators, the I can't do this myth. This myth takes many forms, one of which is a feeling of being completely at sea about how to even begin. Check out the tsunami of logistical questions from my colleagues. Rob, are we meditating today because I didn't dress for that? Ron, I don't have to lay on the floor. Paula, are we going to sit with our legs crossed? Rob, about the breathing, nose, mouth, doesn't matter. Sarah, how do you know when you're done? Jeff sat there taking in the rapid-fire queries from these professional talkers with a combination of amusement and bemusement. Surely, however, my co-hosts are not alone in their confusion. So what follows are answers to the most common early questions. Let's bring in Jeff for that. Hey, man.
Hey, what's up, Dan?
Nice to hear your voice. All right, so let's kick it off. This is the FAQ Meditation Basics. First question, Jeff, where do you recommend that people meditate?
I recommend a quiet place with minimal distractions, but know that it doesn't have to be perfect. Natural settings are also excellent places to meditate.
Does meditation require special clothing?
Not really. Loose pants are better for circulation.
I get this one a lot. Do you need to have your eyes closed when you meditate?
Completely up to you. Many people meditate with their eyes closed. Others like to have their eyes half open, staring at the floor in front of them with a soft gaze. Both are fine. See what feels most natural and agreeable for you.
What's your view on how people should sit?
Sit in a way that allows you to be still, comfortable, and alert. This can happen in a bunch of different ways. So it can happen on a chair, on a floor cushion, even lying down or standing up. But don't fool yourself. If lying down makes you fall asleep, then you're not being alert. If standing up makes you tense, then you're not being comfortable. Most people sit on a straight back chair or on a cushion. For this, your spine should be vertical and your knees should be below the pelvis. If your knees are crossed and bent upward above the pelvis, like the way for some reason people imagine you're supposed to sit in meditation, then this will create tension in the lower back and you'll spend your entire meditation cursing Dan's name. Better to sit in a decent chair with back support or to sit at the edge of a chair with your back straight. As for the hands, either place them gently on the knees or fold them in your lap.
Can you move at all?
Stillness is the ideal. The stiller you get, the cleaner and clearer the signal from the sensation you're paying attention to, like the breath. And ultimately, the more absorbed and settled you'll be able to get. That said, if you need to move, that's completely fine. Just try to bring your awareness to the movement and make it part of the meditation instead of moving unconsciously.
What if you're in really bad physical pain?
It's normal for your ankle or your back or your knee to start hurting after a while, or to have an unusually persistent face itch, at which point all that may be going on in your meditation is you obsessing about the itch or your pain. There's a couple strategies here. One, gently move your leg. That really is fine. Two, investigate the discomfort. There is much to say here about how valuable this kind of an investigation can be, about how we can learn to tease apart our actual pain from our much larger resistance to that pain, which is where the majority of our tension and our discomfort actually lives. We will explore these fascinating and rather life-changing dynamics in a later chapter.
How do you know when you're done with a particular meditation session?
Use a timer. That way you can hit start and then just do your best to forget about it. Otherwise, you might keep peeking, wondering, is it time yet? Is it time yet?
I've been there. Speaking of timing, how long and how often do you think people should meditate?
Finding the time to meditate is probably the biggest single roadblock to establishing a meditation habit. We'll have more to say on this subject as the book progresses. It's important to set realistic goals. We recommend you shoot for 5 to 10 minutes a day, with the very important qualification that if this is not possible, 1 minute of meditation absolutely counts. As a general rule, the more often you meditate, the easier it gets and the deeper and more enduring the benefits. Consistency matters more than length. Meditating every day or two, even for a minute, will help you get a meditation habit off the ground. Then once it becomes part of your everyday routine, you can experiment with length to see what works best for you. All the meditations in the book can be done in under 10 minutes. We include suggested times. Longer sits, though, are always worth exploring.
Is it helpful to listen to ambient music while you meditate?
Well, it's not ideal, because then your attention is split between the thing you're meditating on and the background music. That said, two caveats. One, everyone's a bit different. You may find that music is actually a helpful aid to concentration and doesn't distract from your practice at all. Two, music itself can be the object of meditation. You can zoom in on the auditory qualities. Just keep in mind that music casts a spell and can easily cause you to lose mindfulness.
especially that Enya music. I know you're a big fan. But what about other kinds of meditation, like using a mantra?
In this book, we teach mindfulness meditation, which doesn't involve a mantra. But there are many other ways to meditate. It's really a matter of personal preference. In mantra practice, most famously taught in a school called Transcendental Meditation, or TM, you lightly pay attention to a short, repeated phrase in your head. For a lot of people, this is a very powerful way to get still and concentrated.
But we're talking about mindfulness in this book, and in mindfulness, all we do is pay attention to the breath?
That's the first move, the core practice. But there's a few others. Let me put it in context. Most traditions teach a logical progression of techniques, each building off the previous one. And that's what we're going to do here, with three basic steps. Step one, we focus and calm the mind by concentrating on the breath. In meditation speak, we call the thing we focus on the meditation object. If you don't like the breath, I'll offer some other options. This will be our home base meditation. Concentration's key because you can't get far in meditation if your mind is skittering all over the place like a frenzied chipmunk on a sheet of linoleum, although some skittering is inevitable. Step two. Once our mind has stabilized a bit, we'll widen our attention to include our thoughts, urges, and emotions. When you can see your mental patterns clearly, they don't have as much power over you. It's a hugely, hugely useful skill. Step three, we'll explore a few specialized meditations on movement, on sound, on compassion, and others. Let me draw you a mental picture. If simple concentration is home base, you can imagine it's like a round little ball in the center. That's concentration. Then we'll build outward and use our more stable and balanced awareness to see our unique patterns of thinking and feeling and reacting. So around that ball in the center, you can imagine two other concentric circles. The first one is thoughts, and then the wider concentric circle is feelings. Finally, throughout the book, I'll drop in a bunch of specialized satellite techniques, which you can use as needed. So if you imagine in the very center of our picture, there's the ball of concentration with the two concentric rings around it, sort of like a big planet. Then these little meditations are scattered like moons around our central planet. So you've got free-range meditations, you've got do nothing, you've got one on urges, you've got walking, rest, compassion, and so on. But as I said, we'll start with concentration. It is the foundational skill.
Jeff, you keep talking about concentration, but for many people, there are a lot of negative associations with that word. It sounds hard, unfun, like when our teachers would holler at us to pay attention.
Well, the irony here is that the fruit of concentration is actually one of the most fun parts of the practice. It feels good. Concentration is being in the zone. It's unifying attention into a single stream of activity. It quiets things down inside, which for many of us comes as a huge relief. It's only when we get a break from our endless mental churn of opinions and obsessions and exuberances that we realize how completely exhausting our so-called normal state is. The mind is constantly finding and making problems. As it settles, there are fewer problems. Sometimes it's that simple.
Back in the room with my GMA colleagues, once Jeff had answered the basic questions, he got down to the actual meditation. He had us close our eyes, straighten our spines, and relax our faces. His tone, as always, was both warm and matter-of-fact. I love the way Jeff guides meditation. He sounds like a regular guy with no weird affectations or hushed sing-song delivery. What follows is a version of the basic instructions Jeff delivered to my co-hosts. Again, you don't actually have to meditate right now if you don't want to. I usually find it annoying when authors ask me to do things on their timetable, not mine. That said, the way Jeff teaches meditation is anything but annoying. I find his style fascinating and often very funny. As you listen, you could try to connect with some of the qualities of mind he describes.
Concentration 101, a meditation. 5 to 10 minutes, longer is worth exploring. So we start by taking a couple of deep breaths. On the inhale, that's when you stretch up the spine, find some alertness and composure. On the exhale, settling, softening the body. We start with our attitude. Can you sit in a way that's relaxed and open? This is the quality of equanimity. It's a kind of easygoingness in the way we hold ourselves. I think of it as the Fonzie effect. You're just sitting cool inside your skin, making a commitment to not get uptight about the fact that, one, this meditation thing may feel weird at first, and two, there's almost definitely going to be unwanted distractions and sounds, thoughts, and feelings. It's all totally fine. You're letting all this stuff be there right from the start. This maturity and affability